Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The BBC is quoting unidentified sources saying British investigators are now looking for a fifth suspect in the London bombings. Meanwhile, in the northern city of Leeds, police are still searching homes and removing material they hope will provide clues. For the latest on the investigation, we turn to Charles Sennett of the Boston Globe. He joins us from London. And Charlie, we know that four men were seen on surveillance videos. It's now thought they were suicide bombers, all of them British-born, of Pakistani descent. Tell us about this new development of a possible fifth suspect.
Well, right now, what we're hearing is that police are looking for a fifth suspect who they believe is directly connected to the attacks but remains at large. So the big question is this person who they are looking for the mastermind? Because we had this dramatic break in the case yesterday revealing that the attackers did kill themselves during the blasts. And so what investigators are now really turning to with a lot of intensity is who's behind this? Who is the mastermind? What are the different ways in which these individuals were recruited? And when they explore that, they hope that will open up those who lie behind this terrorist attack.
Right, because Britain has exported suicide bombers in the past, I'm thinking to Israel in particular. But would this be the first suicide bombers to come from Europe and to place the bombs in Europe?
There have been suicide bombings in Russia. There have also been some in Turkey. But in Western Europe, this is the first time we have seen suicide bombings on Western European soil. And just a little word of caution that the police publicly are being very careful not to say directly that these are suicide bombers. Mm-hmm. They're saying that these bombers were killed mm-hmm. during the explosions. It's an interesting thing that off the record they'll tell us it's suicide bombers, but on the record there's a little bit more caution, which is making us all feel the need to be cautious as well. But certainly this has raised the specter suicide bombing in Europe.
Well, what do you think the thinking is? Because we know also that these four young alleged bombers were thought to be very young, very inexperienced. Is there thinking that they possibly didn't know what they had? Or what's the thinking?
Well, I mean, it's hard to put this together because, remember, these bombs all happened in very close sequence, which would suggest timers. Mm-hmm. Yet these bombings also are bombings in which the people who were carrying the bombs exploded themselves when the bombs detonated. Mm-hmm. So I think that some of the logistics of it all, as we were first learning through investigators, was that these were time devices. Now they're saying that the individuals killed themselves. So the questions could be, one, yes, it is suicide bombers. That's kind of the leading theory. Another theory that's not being completely ruled out, though, is the possibility that these were essentially bagmen for the bombs. They were carrying the bombs, which had detonation devices on them, and then they exploded. Right now, I'd say, though, the weight of the investigators we're talking to are putting more weight behind the theory that these were this very feared specter of suicide bombings in Western Europe.
Well, Charlie, where does the investigation go next? Because I know the questions are who trained them, possibly. So where does the investigation go next?
Well, where it goes immediately is on this fifth suspect who remains at large. Where it goes in general is trying to get a sense, an understanding of how these individuals were recruited. Mm. We know that one of them recently had traveled to Pakistan to study in a religious school, according to a family member who was interviewed by the BBC. We also want to keep on the investigators to ask them about the other possible portals, as the investigators call it, for these bombers to have entered into some kind of an Islamic militant cell intent on carrying out terrorism. And by portal, I mean, what is the mosque that was perhaps a kind of incubation area for this kind of extremism? Or what was the internet site that these young kids were tapping into that got them drawn to this? Was the individual who they met who recruited them somehow from a demonstration or from a mosque?
Or as you write, what was the college campus? You write of a government paper that's been leaked that reveals that Al-Qaeda has been recruiting people on campus.
Indeed, this document, which we've seen pieces of, is very revealing because it establishes patterns for this recruitment across Europe from studies of the Madrid bombings and from the studies of other recruitment of European jihadists, if you want to call them that, who are intent on carrying out these attacks. And they're seeing evidence of those mosques where militants take over, and then they bring certain individuals, young, impressionable, angry young Muslims who feel that there is a huge injustice in the way the West carries out its foreign policy in the Middle East, huge injustices in Israel, in the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and who become fired up, and then they bring them sort of underground from those mosques, and then they put them in what investigators are calling nests, and the places they're recruiting these people from are not only the mosques, but as you point out, college campuses, also interestingly, prisons. Mm. We've heard a lot about prison imams who've been active in recruiting people, and indeed this was how Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber, was recruited and converted to Islam inside a British prison.
Charlie Sennett of the Boston Globe speaking to us from London. Charlie, we just have a few seconds, but I just want to ask you very briefly. Tony Blair spoke in the House of Commons today. He said we have to look at how to strengthen procedures, seem to indicate how to deport people if they come here from outside of Britain. Do you get a sense that there's going to be a change in laws in Britain?
Yes, Blair said that openly today, that there need to be tougher laws to end this open incitement to violence that's been going on in the mosques and in some websites that you see, you know, kind of creeping out all over the place. He also talked about the need for Muslims, moderate Muslims, to be enlisted in this fight, and he called it a global drive to tackle what he called an evil ideology that lies behind Thursday's London bombings.
Because in the past, Britain was happy to let some of this hate language be above ground, thinking that was better than being underground, but obviously they're rethinking that. Charlie Sennett of the Boston Globe, again speaking to us from London. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The fate of America's space program hangs in the balance today as NASA prepares to launch the Space Shuttle Discovery this afternoon at 3:51 Eastern Time. The shuttle's 13-day mission comes 2.5 years after the shuttle Columbia disintegrated over Texas during reentry, killing all 7 astronauts aboard and grounding the fleet. Well, today's Discovery mission also marks the beginning of the end for the shuttle program, which is set to be retired in 2010 to make way for the next generation of spacecraft, the Crew Exploration Vehicle, or CEV. We're going to speak to a former shuttle astronaut in a moment about that. But first, Pat Duggins of WMFE in Orlando, Florida, is at Cape Canaveral, where we always expect you to be on these days, Pat. And we understand today the big question is the weather. How does it look there?
Well, let's put it this way. The rain is falling, and we're under a lightning advisory right now. So we're keeping an open mind. You see, this is my 86th shuttle launch, and I've been there for like launches where it's been like a 90% chance of bad weather and we go, and a 90% chance of good weather and we scrub. So until the solid rocket boosters light, I'm going to kind of keep an open mind, sort of.
Well, it begs the question, and I know I've asked you before, but still, why are these launches held during hurricane season?
Well, basically, if you're going to launch any time at all during the summer in Florida, you're going to have the possibility of afternoon pop-up storms. That's simply the way it is. There's a saying in Florida, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. And for right now, for NASA, they're kind of stuck. If they want to launch in July, they have to launch between now and the end of July because of two reasons. Number one, they want to be able to pick a time when the International Space Station is overhead because the shuttle only has so much propellant on board. And number two, they want a daytime launch so if the parts fall off, they can see them more easily.
Well, earlier today, a part did fall off. A temporary plastic cover that was protecting one of the shuttle windows fell, damaged some heat shielding tiles. You know, of course, you read a report like that as a civilian, you think, well, I'd never have a window fall out of the house, but it could potentially happen. Tell us more about how it was repaired and how comfortable they feel.
Well, yeah, there was a bit of embarrassment on NASA's part on that one, but what happened was, okay, the shuttle, as you know, points straight up when it's bolted to the external tank and the boosters. Then you've got the main windshields that the astronauts look forward out of, and then they've got two overhead windows. Now, the cover was on one of those overhead windows, and no one saw it fall. It's basically taped in place until hours before liftoff, and one of the launch crew members was at the bottom of the launch stack, and they see this cover lying there, and all of a sudden they start checking the shuttle. shuttle because they know that cover's not supposed to be there, and that's when they find two cracked heat shields right next to the shuttle's tail fin. Obviously a showstopper at the moment for NASA, but fortunately those tiles were on the outside of a piece of metal called a carrier panel, which literally can be popped out, tiles and all, and then they just put in a replacement, and now they're just simply, you know, examining the repair, making sure there wasn't any additional damage, and at least once they get that taken care of, then the weather's all they have to worry about.
You know, I asked you about the external weather. What about the internal mood? You know, these are people who lost friends in the last launch. They know the world is watching. Just can you give us a sense of the mood there?
It's very emotional, excitement, but also they realize what's at stake. I mean, NASA's top administrator, Michael Griffin, yesterday basically just laid it on the line. He said this mission has to go perfectly. And if it doesn't, then there's the possibility the entire U.S. manned space program might grind to a halt. And if Discovery lifts off and there's a problem, they've got Space Shuttle Atlanta standing by for a rescue flight. And the commander of that mission knows what it's like to lose a friend very closely because his first mission was with one of the Columbia astronauts, Kalpana Chawla, and he's the one who's going to have to go rescue Discovery if there's a problem on launch day.
So given that, we know that after the Columbia accident, there were the requests for many changes to be made. In the few seconds we have, are there some that people worry about that weren't made?
Well, there were three that the Columbia board said that should be done, and NASA did not. They said, number one, harden the outside of the shuttle so debris won't hit. NASA says we're going to retire the shuttle in 2010. We can't do it. They said eliminate all debris coming off the got pretty much all of it taken care of, but there's not much they can do about that. Then they said you have to have a repair method for broken heat tiles. Well, you can't be sure the repairs are going to work until you take the tiles up, repair them, bring them back, and put them in a blast furnace. Otherwise, you're telling the astronauts, okay, if there's a problem, make the repairs, do the reentry. We'll see you on the other side, and if it works, it works. They just can't live with that.
Yeah. Pat Duggins of NPR station WFME in Orlando, Florida, speaking to us from Cape Canaveral, Florida, on what did you say, your 87th launch?
This will be number 86.
Yeah. Pat, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Discovery Commander Eileen Collins reportedly has some butterflies, understandably, as she prepares for today's planned shuttle launch. That's according to her husband, Pat Youngs. George Pinky Nelson can understand just how she's feeling. He was an astronaut aboard Discovery in September of 1988 on the first shuttle mission after the 1986 Challenger tragedy that killed all seven crew members. He joins us on the line. And Pinky, you said I can call you Pinky. Tell me, what's it like for you to return to space after that tragedy? What do you think is going through the minds of the crew today?
Well, on a mission like this, you treat it a lot like any other mission. You're concerned about things going well, and I'm sure for this flight, just like for the flight that I was on with Discovery, that they have a lot of confidence that everyone has checked everything twice and that they're probably on as safe a mission as they're going to have. As far as being on the mission, I think the crew is honored to be on a flight like this. These are professionals, and they are in the astronaut office because flying in space is what they want to do, and they are looking forward to the opportunity to get America back into space again by flying on the Discovery. So they are anxious to have the weather clear up, to have no problems with the mechanical problems with the spacecraft, and to go out and do their jobs. So the crew right now, they just want to go out and fly.
That's former Space Shuttle astronaut George Pinky Nelson. We are going to continue our conversation with him when we come back. He's also a professor at Western Washington University, has some thoughts on the space program. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. While the country holds its breath waiting for the shuttle to take off today, it also has an eye to the future. What are the plans beyond the space shuttle? We've been talking to George Pinky Nelson, a former space shuttle astronaut. Also joining us is Dr. Louis Friedman. He's on the phone, executive director of the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California. Doctor, hold on a second, because Pinky, I just want to ask you, after the Challenger disaster, there were recommendations for massive reforms of NASA's management structure, yet after the Columbia disaster 2 years ago, some of the same problems, such as a fear of questioning authority and a lack of flow of information, were once again cited. So what is it about the culture? Why do you think those changes didn't take place?
Well, I think the changes did take place after the Challenger accident, but it's been a while now, almost 20 years, and the system tends to relax, and you get new people, new leaders, new pressures. So that the challenge is to keep those charges fresh.
Well, Dr. Lewis Friedman, each shuttle mission costs about $1 billion. When the program was first planned, a big selling point was that this reusable spacecraft would be less expensive, more efficient. Overall, what would you say of the shuttle's performance?
Well, I think the shuttle has been a true technological marvel and a very proud technological and technical achievement. It's a fine machine, and it was made well. The problem has been that the program has not been a success. The grounds under which it was sold were just false, and the whole idea of cheap, low-cost, routine access to space was a lot of hype that should have never been allowed to pervade the space program. The achievement of human explorers going up in this machine is remarkable and something I think the country not only would support but has supported and proven over and over again it will support and even accept the risk and loss of life. But it has to be for worthy goals, and routine cheap flight is not a worthy goal, and it's not even an honest promise.
What do you say to critics who say that the shuttle stands in the way of other more high-technology space exploration?
Well, I think the shuttle now does stand in the way of moving human exploration beyond Earth orbit. We have been stuck in Earth orbit for more than 20 years. We achieved the wonderful successes in the Apollo program and looked like we were venturing outward, and we stopped that process. Now we have got a new policy. It's going to change that, and the shuttle is the step that we have to get beyond in order to change that. Let's get these flights over with, and let's get the shuttle retired and the new vehicles built so that we can explore beyond Earth orbit.
And Dr. Friedman, can I ask you about what the plans are for the new vehicles, the Crew Exploration Vehicle, which is the next generation?
The Crew Exploration Vehicle is not going to try to be a vehicle for both cargo and people, and it's not going to be tried to be a reusable booster. Those are very big changes. It'll try to be a much more of a workhorse for getting the cargo into space independent of the crew, and then the crew will be more of just the functions that you want to have humans up there for, which is the preparation of humans to fly long-duration flights, ultimately to interplanetary space.
Pinky Nelson, I want to ask you, former astronaut, what's your thought about this, you know, idea that we should transfer space exploration from manned to robotic?
Well, I think we have to be very careful. NASA's charter is to explore outer space, and you do that both with people and with robotic missions. And so it's up to the government to strike that balance. So the scientific community, especially the astronomers, who, you know, it doesn't help to have people on telescopes unless you're fixing them, like the Hubble.
Very successful.
Yeah, very successful, and just the kind of thing we've proven that you can do and ought to be designed into future missions. A lot of the support for the agency that ultimately supports the scientific endeavors as well as the manned endeavors comes from the human spaceflight side. So I think even at that level, it's a very important part.
Well, you know, I would think so, because the human is the pioneer at the center of it. But, Dr. Friedman, I'm reading that most of the hits at NASA sites, Internet sites, are from people interested in the robotic exploration. And some people are concerned that this will mean that monies will start going to, you know, big industry that build big vehicles and hardware as opposed to the manned exploration. What is your take on that?
Well, I think it's a mistake to look at it as a pile of money that you can just move around at will. People care about the goals of space exploration. Science programs, the Mars exploration missions like Cassini-Huygens have enjoyed great support because they're producing great results. That's what we want in the human program, too. If the human program has suffered any loss of interest, it's because those great goals have been missing, and I think that's the change that we're going to see in the new policy and new programs.
President Bush has set a goal over the next 20 years of manned missions to the moon and Mars between 2015 and 2020. Astronauts will use a version of this CEV, the new vehicle, to land on the moon, build bases. And these bases are intended to be occupied indefinitely with electricity produced from small nuclear reactors. This is just a portion of the plan. Your thoughts on that plan, Dr. Friedman, first.
I think it's a very worthy plan. It's kind of exciting. It knows where the human program leads. It gives a goal that can be forward. The trick is going to be in the implementation of it, keeping your eye on the ball for the long-range goal and not getting bogged down with interim technology steps that are just like the space station that end up being ends in of themselves, but keep moving forward and keep moving outward.
Well, Pinky Nelson, former astronaut, you've been quoted as saying that this is his dad's plan. It was proposed before and shot down because it was way too expensive.
Right. I think it's a noble plan. I agree with Lou. I'd love to see it happen. The problem that I see is that it has to be sold politically, that the country has to buy into it, the Congress has to fund it, it has to be moved up on the priority list, has to be promoted from the administration if something like this is going to happen.
And why should it happen?
I believe it happens because it's what humans being do to survive. We explore the unknowns, we learn about things, and we push back frontiers.
That's George Nelson, Dr. George Nelson, a professor at Western Washington University, a former space shuttle astronaut. And we also spoke with Dr. Louis Friedman, executive director of the Planetary Society in Pasadena. Gentlemen, thank you both for speaking with us on this day when I know you've both got your eyes skyward. And so thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Private Lindy England, the soldier in many of the photos in the Abu Ghraib scandal, said last week that she will plead not guilty to charges of abuse when her court-martial begins again in August. Her earlier confession of guilt was negated by the judge in her case because he thought it was unbelievable. So far, six soldiers have pleaded guilty in the prison scandal. Two others were convicted. Last year, an independent panel appointed by the Pentagon found that top civilian and military leadership failed to exercise oversight at the prison and made mistakes, but not sufficient to warrant their resignations. But the panel concluded that there is both institutional and personal responsibility at higher levels. Well, former Democratic Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman is asking, how high? In the current issue of The Nation, Holtzman cites the Federal War Crimes Act of 1996 and writes that administration members such as Alberto Gonzalez, the current Attorney General and possible future Supreme Court Justice nominee, have some tough questions to answer about that law. To support her position, Holtzman draws upon the Watergate scandal, the War Crimes Act, and Gonzalez's memos to President Bush on Abu Ghraib. Well, we asked her to lay out her thesis, beginning with Mr. Gonzalez and his connection to the War Crimes Act.
Mr. Gonzalez brought it to my attention through not personally, but through a memo he wrote to President Bush when he urged President Bush to opt out of the Geneva Conventions for the war in Afghanistan. And basically, he gave President Bush the following reason. He said, we've got to reduce the possibility of prosecutions under the War Crimes Act of 1996. Well, I looked up the War Crimes Act, and what it does is it says it's a U.S. crime for any U.S. national to engage in grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, which really amount to murdering detainees, torturing detainees, or subjecting them to inhuman treatment. So Gonzalez was very worried about this, and that's one of the reasons that President Bush opted out of the Geneva Conventions for Afghanistan.
And let's further say that the Bush administration argues that the Geneva Conventions excludes terrorists or other unlawful combatants from protection, and so that would, in the Bush administration's mind, cover the detainees at Guantanamo. But you're talking about Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, I'm talking about any detainees in Iraq. Let's just concede, for argument's sake, that the president is right. I don't agree with him that you can just opt out of the Geneva Conventions in this way, but let's just assume that you could. The terrible torture, mistreatment of human beings that occurred in Iraq, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere, people have to be held accountable, and you can't just have the quote-unquote small fry.
I was going to say soldiers have been held accountable. There have been trials.
Yes, but who gave them the orders and who created the conditions? And also under international law, which is incorporated in the War Crimes Act, the commanders, including the commander-in-chief, any commander who knew about the violations had a responsibility to stop them.
Well, what about the argument of national security? As you know, President Nixon tried to make that argument during Watergate, and it was discovered that, in fact, the petty burglary was for political purposes in the Watergate. What about the argument that what's been done, and mistakes have been acknowledged to have been made, but those mistakes were made in the effort to improve national security?
Well, I mean, I think it's very interesting that the Justice Department, during the early days of the Afghan War and early months, took the position that the president could overrule any position of law and any provision of law. And as commander-in-chief, he was a law unto himself. Well, obviously, they don't quite completely agree with that position. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had to opt out of the Geneva Conventions, because then his word was good no matter what. So I think there's a little ambivalence. I know that Alberto Gonzalez refused to be pinned down on the point of whether the president had to obey the law as commander-in-chief. I mean, President Nixon said he was above the law. He claimed there was national security, but in that case, the national security claims were bogus. We don't know what President Bush directed with regard to treatment of detainees. Those directives have never been made public. We don't know what he knew about mistreatment and when he knew it. That information needs to be made public, and not only with regard to the president, but with regard to other top officials, such as Secretary Rumsfeld and the head of the military in Iraq, Lieutenant General Sanchez, and other military officials or Pentagon officials.
The question you pose in your article is, what did Alberto Gonzalez know? What actions by U.S. officials gave rise to his concern about possible prosecution under the War Crimes Act?
Right.
Isn't it possible that as a good lawyer, he was just trying to cover all the bases?
I think he was giving the president very good advice as a lawyer. As a president's personal lawyer, he was basically saying to the president, as I read that, listen, we could all be in trouble under this law, because if you see what he says further down, while he doesn't say who would be covered under the War Crimes Act, when he talks about the fact that down the road we would have to worry about special prosecutors and independent counsels, those were appointed for presidents, President Nixon and President Clinton. So he could not have been using that language without understanding the history. And it's quite clear that the language of the statute is very broad, and inhuman treatment is a very broad term, and inhuman treatment took place in Iraq. So I think there's a lot to worry about, and Mr. Gonzalez is the one who raised that concern in the first place.
What do you think that Congress can do about this? As you point out, Alberto Gonzalez is the Attorney General. So he can't very well launch an investigation.
Well, he could. If there were enough public pressure, he could. He could be forced to do it. He has the power to appoint a special prosecutor. I mean, there are a couple of pressure points now. For example, there's been some talk that Lieutenant General Sanchez will be promoted. That requires Senate confirmation. I would suggest that the Senate ask for the appointment of a special prosecutor before any vote is held on his confirmation to determine whether he engaged in war crimes or committed them. Secondly, with regard to Gonzalez himself, if his name comes up, the question should be raised as to what was his role in shielding people from prosecution by suggesting that they opt out of Geneva Convention, and is that in and of itself an illegal act? And secondly, who was he worried about? Who had already or was about to commit crimes under the War Crimes Act that would have been prosecutable except for opting out of the Geneva Convention? So I think there's a lot of information and there are a lot of opportunities. But as Watergate shows us, it's very hard to hold a president or top officials accountable.
But what if there is no smoking gun, no directive?
Sometimes an investigation will turn up nothing. You can't find the facts or they're too ambiguous. But as we learned in Watergate, the critical thing was to hold people accountable and to say we're going to search for the facts. And you can't just end a scandal as corrosive and as corrupting of our image and of our society as Abu Ghraib by holding the small fry accountable. It's as though in Watergate you just ended with the burglars and said, well, gee, you know, that's all we can do.
Congresswoman Holtzman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's former Democrat Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. Her article, Torture and Accountability, appears in this week's issue of The Nation magazine. Well, still to come, in the age of email and cell phones, we talk etiquette with a woman who's written a book on the subject. You're listening to Here and Now. Picture this. You're at home alone. In fact, you're standing on your bed. Cheap Trick, power chords booming through your room. Suddenly, you're not just strumming an imaginary guitar. You are a rock star.
Mother told me, yes, she told me, I'd meet girls like you.
For most people, the fantasy ends there, but some have turned their passion for air guitar into a professional pursuit. Tomorrow, regional air guitar champions from around the country are going to descend on L.A. for a chance to be crowned the U.S. Air Guitar Champ. Joining us now, reigning New York champ, 34-year-old Dan Crane. Dan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And first of all, I have to say, do I understand that you are a real musician?
That's a little secret I'd like to keep between you and me, but yes, actually I am.
That's not fair. Most air guitarists really wouldn't know where the frets are on the guitar, but you play bass, right?
That's true. I play bass and guitar.
Well, tell me, I mean, so since you do play guitar for real, what's the appeal of air guitar? Most people would say, hey, I play air guitar because I can't play guitar.
Well, I mean, actually, I've had much more success, oddly enough, as an air guitarist than as a so-called real guitarist. It does offer, you know, particularly for people who don't play an instrument. You know, as a kid, when I grew up, I would literally get up on top of my bed. My room had rock posters, on all the walls, and I would be transported into, the arena of rock. And it's basically just an extension of that. It's for anybody who's, never played an instrument to get up on stage in front of hundreds, thousands of people, cheering fans, and, to be a rock star. And, the best thing about air guitar is that, your sets are really short, 60 seconds usually, and there's no gear to schlep around, so that, that's definitely a bonus.
And as a guitarist, you're probably pretty good as Dan Crane, but as an air guitarist, you could be Pete Townsend.
Exactly, or Jimmy Page, for that matter.
Right, well, and in fact, tell me some of the things that guitarists do that you emulate. Tell me some of the moves. Now, Pete Townsend, I'm thinking of that big circle he does.
Sure. I mean, the windmill is kind of a classic yet, almost cliche move for an air guitarist. I mean, air guitar really is about kind of a hyper-explosive version of what guitarists normally do.
Your favorites, by the way, that you emulate?
My favorite guitarists?
Mm-hmm.
My favorite guitarists are probably Jimmy Page, Keith Richards. I'm a big Gordon Lightfoot fan, although he was not a...
Really, a great
air guitar.
Well, I think of them but they're not the ones I think about. Again, I'm not thinking about crazy smashing the guitar on the stage. What is it about those guys that you like?
Well, Gordon Lightfoot's just he's a mellow dude from Canada, which I like him. Jimmy Page and Keith Richards, it's really about swagger. It's really about having this kind of confidence on stage that you've been doing this your whole life. Mm-hmm. It's sort of one part sexuality, one part swagger.
Well, tell you what, we have some music that we'd like to rack up. This is Ballroom Blitz.
Okay.
And I know you like the artist.
Sweet, yeah, they're a big influential 70s glam rock band.
Well, we're going to play it a little bit.
Okay.
And since this is radio, I'd like you, if you wouldn't mind, play air guitar, but also narrate for us. Tell us, what are you doing? Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Are you making a grimace?
I don't like to think of it as a grimace, as more of a smirk. But yeah, I'm kind of looking out on the audience, feeling the song, I'm feeling the groove.
Uh-huh. Are your hands both on the guitar? Is one shooting up in the air at all, or...?
This almost feels like phone sex, to talk about air guitar on the phone. But yes, my hands are on the neck of the guitar, and I'm kind of strumming. My hands are sliding down, and my head's bouncing.
Okay, I think that's enough of that. Dan Crane,
yeah.
Air guitarist, who's going to be I'm actually blushing.
Oh, well. Keep going if you'd like. I'm just getting warmed up.
Oh, yeah!
Dan Crane, New York air guitar champion, going for the national title tomorrow. If he wins, he'll compete for the world title this August in Finland. He's also in the real band Les Enfants Terribles. Probably not as much fun. Stay with us. More ahead. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When is it best to tell a new date you take Viagra? Answer, before you get lusty, and don't take it unless you're sure of the night's outcome or you will need a cape. Well, that's just one of the tips in etiquette maven Mary Mitchell's new book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Etiquette. She's known as Ms. Demeanor in her nationally syndicated column, and she joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Welcome.
Why, thanks. Good to be here.
Complete idiots, that's kind of how we feel lately when it comes to etiquette, because there have been so many changes over the last two decades. You make a distinction between etiquette and good manners. First of all, what's that difference?
Good manners come from the inside. It's an attitude. It's something you feel towards other people. Mm. Etiquette, on the other hand, comes from the outside, and they're a set of rules, do's and don'ts, and nobody is born knowing them. So we all have to learn them, because respect and common sense can take you just so far, but in the long run, we end up being judged on how well we know the rules.
Right. You also talk about new situations in which there is new etiquette. I was so surprised to open the book and see yoga class. What do we need to know about yoga class? Give us one thought.
Probably if there's one class to be early for, it's yoga class. Never interrupt a yoga class when it's in progress, and don't leave early.
A thought about, sort of the new age thinking about etiquette. But then there's the ongoing topics like, let's just get right to it, sex. And the proper etiquette. In the age of sexually transmitted diseases, for instance, you talk about how to, if you're in a new relationship, deal with concerns about STDs. It's perfectly acceptable to ask someone to get tested?
Yes, it is. It's not comfortable to ask someone to get tested, but it's important to ask someone. And the way you do that is you say it in language as though you'd say it's raining outside. No emotion, no apology, just a statement of fact.
It's raining outside, by the way, is one of your mantras throughout the book. It's raining outside is what? It's a dispassionate way of speaking?
Well, it's a way that has no emotion. When we're about to say something that can be controversial or make somebody upset, if you say something like, yes, I really would appreciate it if you'd not smoke here.
It has that tone. It's not judgmental.
Right? No, it's not judgmental at all.
So back to sex. You're chatting with someone. You say, oh, look, it's raining outside. Would you mind getting tested for STDs? But here's my question to you, and others in the office had it as well. That's one thing. But how do you know someone's telling you the truth? Is it proper etiquette to say that you want proof that someone was tested for a sexually transmitted disease?
Well, I think if you have your doubts, you really ought to be thinking twice about having sex in the first place.
Moving on to business etiquette, because business is a world that's changed as well. You write some of the faux pas are being overly solicitous to women. That's sort of from a bygone era. But what do you think is the number one business etiquette faux pas?
I would say the number one business etiquette faux pas would be being late. It's just like stealing somebody's money. And what we tend to do, because we're so information bombarded and we're so dedicated to multitasking, that we think, oh, well, it'll just take a second. It'll just take a second. Meanwhile, you might have somebody waiting in person for you, and that person's time is valuable.
You put several reminders throughout the etiquette in the workplace chapter. Never stay behind your desk when a visitor arrives. Remember that when you delete an email, it doesn't go away. It stays somewhere in the company. If you're meeting someone at a business cocktail party, keep your drink in your left hand so you don't give someone a cold, wet handshake. Here's a question that came from our office. What do you do if you have a coworker who is bearing way too much midriff with some of the new clothing that younger people wear? Is that just a generational thing, or do you have the right to say something to someone?
It's largely a generational thing. And it sure is a lesson I wish other people would learn, because it just flies in the face of business and business behavior and professionalism. So the first thing to remember is, if you're going to say something to someone, Do you have the right? In other words, are you in a management position? Are you a superior to this person in the pecking order? Or are you simply a colleague and a peer? And in both cases, the key thing here is to get the person alone. Make sure that you never criticize another person in public. And there's a very good reason for this. When someone is criticized in public, they don't hear what you're saying. They're busy building their defense.
As I call it, my Supreme Court argument.
Exactly. And then you want to talk in terms of observable behavior and observable fact. And that might sound something like, you know, bear midriffs just don't work in this company culture.
There's just so much advice throughout the book. Can we do a lightning round on dining? Your water glass.
Water glass is on the right.
Your butter plate?
Butter plate is on the left. If you think in terms of drink right, eat left, and the first two letters of the word drink are DR, that'll help you.
Napkin?
Napkin on the lap. And use it.
Right.
And when you're not, if you excuse yourself from the table, put the napkin back on your chair.
Couple questions from our office, couple more questions. You have a section on obesity etiquette.
Yes.
Why did you include that, by the way?
Because etiquette across the board only reflects the economy and the social structure of any group of people. In this case, there are 1 in 3 Americans who are obese. How many of us have been on buses, on airplanes, and had to deal with someone who is grossly overweight?
Well, in fact, one of my colleagues asks, what do you do when you're on a long flight, in coach, and an obese person sits next to you and in part on top of you?
Yes, it's happened to me. And actually, that's one reason why I did this chapter, because I really felt I needed to understand more. What I did was I came away feeling a lot more compassionate towards the obese because I realized how unbelievably discriminated against they are. So in the case of the airplane, if you're able to move your seat, the thing to do is to get up and ask the attendant if there's another place you might sit. Failing that, you know, life is just not about even exchanges. And there are times when we have to be inconvenienced and times when we can avoid it.
We had another question from the office that is as old as they come with etiquette, which is, how do you determine who steps back from a revolving door, a man or a woman? Is it impolite to step back for a woman if, in fact, that woman might feel offended? I mean, how do you make those decisions, those age-old gender decisions about, you know, who goes first?
In today's workplace, whoever needs the help gets the help, regardless of gender. In a social setting, you know, going back to chivalry, of course, the man would go through the door first because the assumption was that the lady was a fair damsel and too fragile.
But then didn't it change and the man would step back and gallantly throw out his arm, you go first?
Yes, that did change. And there's a lot of confusion out there on these very topics, like pulling out chairs and so forth.
Oh, I know. You can end up in sort of like a wrestling match over a chair or a door. So what do you do?
Again, the rule is whoever needs the help ought to get it first. So if you see someone who's got his hands full of files and a door in front of him, you open the door.
Mary Mitchell is author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Etiquette. Mary, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.